From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 5 years since Tom Stoppard was last on the show to talk about his play, The Invention of Love, but he'd been very busy in the meantime, and you can see some of the fruits of his labors right now at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater. It's the first of a trilogy of plays called The Coast of Utopia, and the trilogy features a wonderful cast, including Billy Crudup, Richard Easton, Jennifer Ely, Ethan Hawke, Amy Irving, and Martha Plimpton, to name just a few of the many well-known actors in this cast, and I'm delighted that this has given me a chance to speak with Tom Stoppard one more time. Hello.
Hello.
So how far were you into the writing when you realized that this project would be a trilogy? Had you started off thinking you were just going to write a single play?
No, I'd got as far as making a rather long list of the things I wanted to be in the play, and there was a comical moment when I still thought maybe I could do the whole thing in one play, but I in the end had to call up the theatre who were waiting for this one play and to confess that I thought I was writing three plays.
And Trevor Nunn was to direct, and how did he react?
Well, he was fine about it. In fact, he was quite pleased, but we ended up going a year later than I originally thought that I'd be ready for. So, no, he was okay about it.
And how long in all did you work on these plays?
If you can call it work, I had a really, really enjoyable time reading about all these people for perhaps a couple of years or more. And as a matter of fact, it was so enjoyable, I probably went on too long and didn't leave myself quite enough time to write all three before they were needed, which is one of the best things about my life at the moment, is that I've had this opportunity to come back to these plays, and it was an opportunity I never had in London, because we opened all three plays on the same day in London, and they were just kind of tumbled onto the stage. And
nine straight hours. It was kind of a marathon production.
Yes, we must point out to the members of the public, I hope, that the 9 hours includes the meal breaks. It's not it's not dawn to dusk, and not dawn to midnight.
It's the least you could do.
In fact, I've stopped referring to this as my nine-hour trilogy. I now refer to it as my eight-hour trilogy, which I think is nearer the truth, because I've made some adjustments, and the dynamic is different here. It won't be that long.
But you're not going to be presenting them all in a row as you did in London. You're doing them each as a discrete play, and they function as discrete plays, don't they?
Pretty much. I mean, that's certainly the line I take in public and in private. I like to think of them as plays which stand up on their own individually. And more controversially, I also tend to insist that you can see them in any order, because we all know what a prequel is and what a sequel is and so on. But I think most people tend to see them in, as it were, in chronological order, yeah.
Although even in the plays, I've seen Voyage, the first play, and the first act takes place after the second act takes place. So we're not seeing even that in real time sequence.
I like playing with time. I think the plays, in a way, are about time. In Voyage, the first play, the second act dovetails into the first act, so it's a zigzag in time. If I'd followed the chronological line of the play, we would have been dodging between the country estate outside Moscow and being in Moscow, which would have been irritating. I like messing about with time, as a matter of fact.
But it also leads to some odd situations. One of the characters whom I'd grown rather fond of died, and then I was happy to see her alive again because we were now going to an earlier time and understanding how she had come to the situation she'd come to.
It's the last part that you just said, which is the part that matters. It's the fun of seeing something before you understand how they arrived at that situation or that moment. And yes, I said fun, and I mean fun. It's a sort of rather general way of putting it, but I like it.
Well, you've often talked about how you still see yourself as a playwright who writes for laughs, even in serious plays of this sort. Because you always want to have fun, or because that's the way you think?
It's the way I think. I think that, you know, in a way, the plays are always the author, aren't they? It's how you express yourself, and so the play, as it were, stands for you and has your personality to quite a large degree. I've never managed to write anything which isn't supposed to work a little bit on a comedy level.
Although at the beginning you were more totally comic in your plays. The early ones were quite funny and antic, and now the jokes come in different ways. They grow out of the situations, perhaps, more than out of the interactions rather than out of the
yes.
whole concept of a play is something that's going to be funny.
Yeah. Situation comedy, I absolutely adore. It's difficult to do. I don't actually do it much. I wish I could do it more. Wit is a different thing, verbal wit. I'm given it in a way. I don't work at it. But the kind of laugh which every playwright really loves is the one which doesn't involve anything witty being said. It's, oh, look, she's going to come in, he's going to be there, or whatever it is. Plays are partly a sequence of ambushes of one kind or another. And I think that the trick of it is a lot to do with the way that you allow the information to flow from the stage to the audience. It's the speed at which it flows, and sometimes it's the order in which the information arrives.
Is that why you have always rewritten your plays as they're being produced? Because as you watch them, you realize that you want to make those adjustments so you can get those effects?
Oh, well, I like the way that sentence came out, Leonard, because I don't rewrite, but I do adjust, yes. No, I don't rewrite plays. I mean, I've made lots of adjustments.
Oh, the first edition never seems to be the same as the second edition.
Yeah, I know. I always warn the publisher, say, look, you can do this, but as soon as we're in a rehearsal, I'll be tinkering with it and doing this and doing that, which is what always happens. It happened a lot with Voyage, the first of these Russian plays. But at the same time, it's completely the same play. Somebody who saw it in London and somebody who saw it in New York may not even know I'd done anything.
On the other hand, in London we had a different director, a different cast,
yeah.
and a different kind of theater. That was Proscenium Arch. Here at the Vivian Beaumont, we have an amphitheater. It's not exactly in the round, but it is a very wide stage, and it's kind of, and with a big curve in the front.
Yeah, I like working for a picture frame. I love Proscenium Arch theatres. Utopia actually was done in the Olivier Auditorium in London, which is a bit like the Beaumont. It wasn't done in the picture frame theatre, but coming here and starting again with a truly American show, a new designer, and I don't mean they all have to be American, but just doing it again for New York, not, as it were, importing the one that we prepared earlier. Sometimes that seems to be the way to go. I think probably with my next play, I guess we'll probably try and do what the History Boys did and come into New York with our London show.
That's Rock and Roll, that's the one that opened this year.
Yes.
At the Royal Court.
Yes. That's a play. Well, I've never had a play on at the Royal Court, by the way. And that, so it was a big thing for me. You know, the Royal Court Theatre was the theatre where this particular epoch, if that's the word, of British theatre kicked off. The famous Look Back in Anger of 1956. That's when I first started going to the theatre in London, and I've always wanted to have a play there, and I never had.
There's nothing like it here. I actually worked at the Royal Court, pulling flies and moving sets for a production of Platonov with Rex Harrison.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, well, I was just in the back. I was nobody. And it was illegal, I think. I was a student at the time. But one of the things I thought that was wonderful about the Royal Court is that they gave a play 1 month to make it. And if the play did well, then it would move to a West End theater. And we don't have anything like that here. 1 month really is what a play that is taking chances needs, don't you think? At least a month.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's a theater which plans a season. I don't think that's unknown here, surely. Something similar happens.
Plays will start off Broadway and then move to Broadway or move to a bigger theater, but it's not the same. The Royal Court is committed. I don't know if it still is, but it was when I lived in London, that 1 month. My guess is Tom Stoppard, whose latest production in this country, anyway, is The Coast of Utopia, which is at Lincoln Center at the Vivian Beaumont at 150 West 65th Street, and now in previews, but will open later this month. And then what happens, because you're the same cast is rehearsing the next two plays?
There are 36 actors in the company, and most of them are in all three plays. And after this interview, I'm going to the theatre to sit in on the continuation of the rehearsal of the second play. And we'll be continuing to work on the second play while the first play is being performed.
It must, and actors can do this sort of thing, but it always boggles the minds of the rest of us that they can be performing in one play and keeping that in their heads while they're working on another play. But it's kind of like repertory, but they're playing the same characters.
Four of the characters continue right through the trilogy, but in most cases, actors are taking on different roles in each play. And that's really pretty hard, I would think. Exciting.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, let's talk about these characters that they're playing and this time in Russia during the reign of Tsar Nicholas I that Tom Stoppard has written about in The Coast of Utopia, his trilogy that's at the Vivian Beaumont at Lincoln Center. We're back with Tom Stoppard. His trilogy, The Coast of Utopia, is now being performed at the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. Actually, the first of three plays. Can you explain the three plays to us?
Well, the three plays span about 30 years, and they follow a group of friends, young men and women, from the beginnings of the opposition to autocracy and the Tsar in Russia. It all began, what ended in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution, began pretty much with a very small group of young people who were living in Moscow and left Russia. And the play, in fact, brings them to Paris and ultimately to London and ends up in Switzerland. The way in which revolution evolved and grew is actually quite subtly began as a opposition among repentant aristocracy rather than rebellious peasantry or anything like that. But it was succeeded by a much tougher, harder generation of new men who did not come from the upper reaches of society and had lived lives of suffering.
Well, at this time, there's still serfdom in place in Russia. That didn't end until after the American Civil War, and the Tsar's son, I guess it was, Nicholas II, was it, who decided, inspired by what had happened here, decided to free the serfs.
It was Alexander II.
Oh, Alexander.
Still known as the reforming Tsar, though quite honestly, if you'd been living there, you wouldn't have thought much of his reforms. But nevertheless, the serfs were emancipated, 1861.
But the what we're seeing here is a totally repressive society. People afraid at times to say what they think because even the most mildly indiscreet thing could land them in prison. And here you have these men who and women who are just filled with ideas.
Yes. Their timing was quite good. They arrived in Paris just in time for the Year of Revolution, as it subsequently became known, 1848. Europe was supposed to revolt and throw the emperors down. It never happened, of course. And even in France, where the Second Republic was proclaimed, that degenerated into a kind of imperial republic and finally into an open out-and-out monarchy. So it was a voyage of disillusion and disaster, in a sense, which is why the second play is called Shipwreck. And then it ends with a kind of recuperation and an attempt to look back to Russia and to the future, salvage.
And it started, you've said, with something you read about the literary critic Belinsky, and that sparked this whole play?
Well, it was the first thing I remember getting hold of. This is about a young man who is working under difficult conditions in a police state, and he is in fact enabled to go to Paris to France for his health. He was dying of consumption at the time.
Played by Billy Crudup in this incredible performance that he gives.
He does, Billy Crudup does. And his friends, notably Michael Bakunin, who was the young anarchist, or the future anarchist rather, played by Ethan Hawke, they were really begging him, saying, don't go back. You'll end up in jail and so on. And he said, no, I have to go back because back in Russia, a writer really counts, and he doesn't really count in the West the way that he really counts in an autocracy where censorship rules. So, in fact, I picked up an echo of this in Eastern Europe after communism fell. Of course, everything, most things were very, very much better, but there's a price to pay for commercial freedom.
Saul Bellow also wrote an essay in which he said that words count more in Eastern Europe than they do in the West, and he kind of envied writers, even though they were living in such a repressive situation.
I didn't know Saul Bellow had written that, and you really interest me because that's exactly the point. Exactly the point. I mean, I feel uncomfortable claiming.
Readers had to read between the lines. They had to understand what was really being said, and writers had to be more subtle in the process.
Yes, but we mustn't fall into the trap of saying it was worth it. I mean, you don't really want to have a friend of yours who happens to be a writer living under those conditions just so he can feel better about being a writer.
So it starts off with Belinsky and this realization, but at a certain point, we wind up with Alexander Herzen really taking over as the hero, with a lot of other people who don't seem to agree on anything. Bakunin and Herzen and Belinsky don't really share their ideas. And then we have Turgenev, the great novelist, as part of this group, who's different again. He's kind of an elder statesman. So how were they just friends because they were also smart?
Well, they were all pretty much of an age. They were smart, and they were also, I suppose, politically and socially aware, beyond their generation, which generally just lived with what was possible, became rather superfluous to society and were known as the superfluous men, or they joined the army or whatever it was. This was a time of intellectual ferment as well as social ferment. and they were bright young men. And perhaps one should also mention that that's not entirely what we're writing about here. They also fell in love and fell out of love and had fights and they made up and so on. It was a very kind of human chaos, as chaotic as any human life, but perhaps more so in their case. And they ended up far from home.
Is that why the first play, Voyage, feels to some degree as though Chekhov were sitting on your shoulder while you were writing it, perhaps Maxim Gorky?
I don't think I'm the only English writer who would love to write a Chekhov play.
Not a writer in general, I think.
Probably. I did see a Gorky play in London, Summer Folk, and I looked at the set and thought, oh, I'd like to write a play just for that set. Don't move it. Leave it there. I'd like to write something and just put it on the stage right there.
And is that what Voyage is?
Well, no. The first act of Voyage, which is the first play, does take place at a gentleman's country estate 150 miles from Moscow. So it's almost Chekhovian before anybody, as it were, shows up on the stage. But it's small talk and large talk. And that's a mixture which is interesting to work on.
And you've written a play like this at a time when playwrights might be tempted to dumb down. Here you are writing a play about the people for whom the word intelligentsia was coined. They're talking about philosophy. They're talking about ideas. I suspect somebody said to you, Tom, this might be too difficult for some audiences.
No, I think... They just
expect that from you?
No, I think we're getting... I think the premise is wrong. The character, for example, might be absolutely obsessed with German philosophy, let's say, idealism. And it's necessary and no trick to establishing that this character is obsessed with something which he refers to. He might refer to a writer or to an idea. We don't have to actually be inside his head. We only have to understand that something has bitten him. And, of course, that's not an intellectual problem.
And we don't have to really know what Hegel wrote, as long as we know that Hegel means something specific to this character.
Don't imagine that I've read a lot of Hegel. I haven't. I know what he represents, and that's all I want to know, need to know.
My guest is Tom Stoppard, who's The Coast of Utopia, is currently at the Vivian Beaumont at Lincoln Center, the first in the three plays of the trilogy, and it has a cast that includes Billy Crudup, Richard Easton, Jennifer Ely, Ethan Hawke, Amy Irving, Martha Plimpton. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The Coast of Utopia has the word utopia in it, and that is key here. That is the idealism we were just talking about.
Yes, the idea that somewhere there is a possibility of a society which works in every respect, it's just, it's harmonious, and people will, as it were, live properly together.
In other words, what Marx was talking about, what Bakunin was talking about, even though he didn't agree with Marx.
I think the yearning for such a society goes back thousands of years. An understanding of what such a society would entail, and perhaps one should say an understanding of why it cannot be achieved, is more recent. But utopia actually means no place. There's no such place. This is why philosophy is still being read and taught, because these questions in the end are insoluble. How do you maximize equality on the one hand and liberty on the other? There comes a point where they come into conflict with each other. So all societies are some attempt at a balance.
And that Maoist idea that to make an omelet you have to break some eggs is something that many people who believe in a utopian end would subscribe to. Alexander Herzen, the hero of these plays, he turns out to be, sees it quite differently. He seems to have a very modern take on all of these matters.
Yeah. You know, we talk about Russia a lot, and it's only the first play which is set in Russia at all. Well, there's one scene in the second play. But in fact, what is, for me, very moving about the whole story of these people is that when they were young men in Russia, the future was outside. Russia was just a hopeless case, a lost case. They had to get out and then make a revolution and import it into Russia. And when all their ideals fell down around them in France and they found themselves as refugees in England, their thoughts went back to Russia, and they began to see that they turned their backs on millions of peasantry who were already organized into communes, and there was some kind of possibility of a Russian democracy, a Russian republic, a Russian freedom. And they were working towards something which actually almost came to pass, which is to say, yes, the autocrats, the emperor, was overthrown, and bit by bit things happened. But finally, it was as though human nature couldn't rise to the challenge, and the instincts for domination were the instincts which prevailed among the Russians. It's absolutely tragic and fascinating to think of what Herzen would have made of Russia in the 20s.
Do you see any lessons to be drawn from the story today?
Well, Herzen ends up saying that, you know, we're not grown up until we realize that we can't kill our way towards a utopia. This is the conundrum. He complains that the French have shed more blood for liberty than any other country and understand liberty less. He had a phrase, and by the way, let me tell all your listeners that the best phrases in this play come from Herzen, who was a genius. And one of his phrases was that the French were building prisons out of the stones of the Bastille. In other words, they had the energy to destroy, but when it came to deciding what was going to replace the monarchy, the instinct to dominate, to tell people who was in, who was out, where they could walk, where they couldn't walk, what they could say, what they couldn't say, that in that instinct, you know, came to the front again. And perhaps that's true of all societies. When I came to England, this is a very long sentence, Leonard, I'll try and find a semicolon, but when I first came to England, I really fell in love with England. And one of the things which mattered most to me was that the idea of freedom of speech seemed to be one of the bedrock foundations of the society. I was too young to formulate these things to myself, but I was a journalist when I'd finished my education. I was a journalist for some years, and I always was in love with the idea, not just the idea, but the practice of journalism and the importance of there being a free voice, just as the way we are speaking now. I don't know exactly how, it's sometimes hard to tell how free your voice is, because you could have the illusion of freedom, and there's a degree of self-censorship abroad in democracies, even in this one.
And not just self-censorship. At a certain point, while England is one of the great democracies, it is repressing people in Northern Ireland, and there are massacres and the like. The United States right now is going through all sorts of traumas because of concerns about how much we're being watched and whether torture is something that we could consider as a part of our current idea of what a society is all about.
Look, there is an erosion of everything which made me feel lucky to be turned from a young Czechoslovakian child into an English child. There's been a terrible erosion of all the things which made me proud of Englishness. And certainly freedoms are being curtailed. You know, even majority jury verdicts, for example, that seems to just knock a plank out from underneath what I grew up believing. The thing which we were talking about earlier, the difficulty of making a harmonious and logical balance between the need for liberty and equality and democracy and so on, the appearance of this new figure, the terrorist, has altered that balance terribly. We're now talking openly about, well, maybe it's okay to torture a few people for a very large reward to the common good. And maybe it's okay if they don't have any kind of trial for 3 years. I've written a play in which a young Czech person extols, he's speaking for me, I guess, even in the late 60s, all this was still pretty much in place, all the things which I found when I got to England, and he extols all this, and it's terrible experience in a way to listen to him speaking in a theatre in 2006, because you're listening to him about trial by jury and independent judges and so on, and you think, yeah, well, that's not true anymore. The bits of it have fallen away.
Now, that is in Rock and Roll, your latest play. Is that coming to the United States anytime soon?
Soon enough for me, about a year.
Meanwhile, we have these three, and one is being performed right now, but only part-time because of rehearsals for the second. And then I assume that one will go into previews, and then rehearsals for the third. And then will we just see all three produced one after the other?
Yes, when the third one joins the first two, all three will be playing. And there'll be occasions where you can see them all on the same day. And I was completely wrong when I told them that people don't want to see a play after breakfast because those tickets sold first. I had a pair of shoes repaired in New York the other day, so I'm now, as far as I'm concerned, a resident. I've got a flat in New York for the first time because it takes a long time to put on three plays.
Meanwhile, are you thinking about something new?
No. Thinking about is easy. I can pretend I'm doing that. I haven't got something new. And I'm sorry about that, because the best position to be in is to have a good idea for a play just before the previous one opens.
Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia, being presented in three separate plays and then all together, if you wish, at the Vivian Beaumont at Lincoln Center, 150 West 65th Street. For tickets, you can call 212-239-6200. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It was a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.